Welcome to another episode of Repeak. We are a show about remakes, reboots, and revivals because nothing is original anymore. My name is Diana Olympia.
And I'm Stephanie Kim. Welcome to our fearless re-release, reboot, Taylor's Version emergency mini episode. We are taking a break from our originally scheduled bi-weekly programming to bring you this bonus episode. We're really excited. But first, I wanted to talk to you, Dio. Have you read The Kiss Quotient?
Yes. I read it, I think, a couple years ago. I was in a beach read mood, let's say, and reading a bunch of things in this kind of genre. I really enjoyed it, actually. So I am a little bit nervous about the movie adaptation because I feel like Helen Huang, the author, was able to create such great chemistry between these two obviously fictionalized characters. And I just think it's going to be a really high bar to kind of try to recreate in obviously a live action setting. And so I just hope whoever they cast will be able to capture that magic at least a little bit.
I bring this up because I was reading The Kiss Quotient recently and I thought of you because they mention Daniel Henney really early on in the book. So what are your sort of like ideal casting ideas for both, I guess, the male and the female leads? Do you have any ideas on the female leads?
The female one I feel like is maybe trickier. And it's been a while since I've read it. In my head, I thought these were two Asian American leads or leads with Asian descent, but I actually don't even remember if that's true. I think I just assumed because of the author, and maybe that was a bad assumption, but I just assumed in kind of the romance genre, that felt like there wasn't a ton of that representation. So I'm gonna just go from an Asian American kind of or Asian lead standpoint. For the male, sadly, I think he is out of the age range now, but I would love to see Daniel Henney in a big screen film. I'm not going to say no to that. He still looks good, ladies. Check out that Instagram. He has two dogs and it's just like very sweet and wholesome. He just like loves to hang out with his dogs. I actually don't think it should be Henry Golding. I know that's maybe a hot take, but I just feel like he's having his moment and like other people should have his moment also. So I would maybe pick somebody else from that movie, though, from Crazy Rich Asians, and give Chris Pang a shot. He has an accent.
Yeah, Colin.
I know maybe the character doesn't have an accent, but maybe we could just like change that part. I will always pitch Manny Jacinto because that jawline deserves to be seen everywhere. So that's my picks for the man. For the woman, I don't know. Again, I think like so much, as we've talked about, of these rom-coms and romantic storylines is so much hinges on the chemistry. So I do think we just need to pick whoever pairs the best together. I don't know. Did you envision people as you were reading this?
Yeah. So for the woman, they never confirm nor deny if she is Asian or not. But my assumption is that she is white because when she goes to the male lead's house for dinner and things, it's just a very foreign environment to her. She's not used to it. And for those of you who don't know, the female lead is also interesting because she is neurodivergent. I believe she has Asperger's, and this is the first or one of the first female leads in a romance that I've ever read with that particular
situation.
Yes, the situation that she has to deal with, it's quite different. And then there's this whole interesting like fake dating trope that I would 100% buy into. It's basically the plot is Pretty Woman, but in reverse. Like the woman is the one with all of the money and she hires basically a male prostitute to help her practice dating. And so she knows what to do and like how to interact with her male counterparts because she's had sex before, but it's never been like a super positive experience. So she's trying to like learn how quote unquote normal people or typical people do it. And so it just sets up, you know, like if you're not a fan of the Pretty Woman trope or the fake dating trope, this is definitely not for you. But if you are, it sets up a really fun, interesting dynamic. And I love that it's flipped. I think I was less fixated on picturing a specific type of actress for the lead female, just because I haven't seen, I like would hope that they would also pick somebody when they're casting who is neurodivergent and atypical. And I just don't think that we've seen anybody like openly like that in Hollywood before. So I would want them to cast somebody who's an unknown. But for the male, I was definitely picturing Charles Melton. And I am very pro. I know, but I know he's not a good actor, but like he's exactly like physically the right type.
Is he?
Okay. He is, though. Like, he's supposed to be all muscular. He's also supposed to be half Asian. He's just, like, supposed to be hyper sexy. And, like, Charles Melton is all of those things.
He's had his turn. Everybody else has to eat, too.
No, but, like, what else? Like, what? He's not doing anything besides Riverdale right now.
Well, you know, Chris Pang I haven't seen since Crazy Rich Asians. And Manny hasn't worked since The Good Place. So, you know. These other fellas gotta eat too, okay? There are many, many handsome men in our Asian community, and I just want more of them to be seen and to be celebrated and objectified just like Charles Melton, okay? They deserve that.
Well, I feel like Charles Melton's the only one who really reaches that Tom Ford level of attractiveness. Although I will say Chris Pang is extremely hot, and I would not protest if he were cast in this.
Yeah, agreed.
But okay, so like on the record then, since this is just a little bit of fun, let's put a wager on it. I'm betting on Charles Melton getting cast, and you're betting on who?
So like any of my picks would be more like a wish fulfillment as opposed to who I actually think they would cast. If I go for who I think they'll cast, I mean, Henry Golding's actually also too old also. Sorry, but like he is.
Yeah, he is. I think Chris Pang could actually do it, could actually be cast. I think that's a plausible.
Okay, I'll go with him just for the sake of like manifestation and putting it out into the universe. So Chris Pang, if you get this, I'm just saying, if you get an extra ticket to the premiere, I'm not saying take me as your date. I'm taking myself. I'm just saying I would like to get an advanced screening at least. I don't need to walk the carpet. I just want to be able to see it. Okay. And a plus one for my partner friend here, okay? That's it.
Thank you. Oh, my God. Even when I lose the bet, you're, like, thinking of me.
We would need
so
to be
nice.
Covering it for science. Oh, my God. We could do, like, a live from the red carpet repeat episode. Chris Pang, call me. Tweet me. Let's get
Amazing.
Together.
Amazing.
Again, not romantically, I'm taken.
Oh,
that's
God.
A segue
okay.
into Fearless.
Good segue. Let's segue into Taylor Swift's seminal 2008 album, Fearless. We are recording this on Sunday, April 11th. This was released on Friday, April 9th. What are your initial feelings, Dio, of this re-release specifically?
Yeah, I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about it. I was kind of neutral going into it because when I had heard the Love Story re-release, I was kind of meh about it. It seemed pretty close to the original, and I guess I was anticipating something a little bit more, not of a departure, but just maybe something a little bit different. But then I read an article that she gave where she talked about wanting to really kind of stay true to the original melodies and things like that. And she was really just trying to focus more on the production side and how, you know, kind of her and her team could leverage today's technology and equipment just to kind of improve upon the sound that way. And then looking for maybe slight changes in inflection here and there. And so when I use that framework, I think I really enjoy the album because it really was about appreciating and noticing some of those production kind of level up, so to speak. Like Hey Steve in particular, I think the bass line is completely different in a really great way where it's like nice and thick and it just adds a nice texture to it. I think her voice obviously is a totally different tone. It's deeper and she just sounds way more confident in her vocals. It's really somebody who clearly is a recording artist who's been doing this for over a decade as opposed to, you know, a very young teenager who was kind of still getting her sea legs in the recording booth. But this is somebody who's a seasoned professional who's come in, knows how to hit her marks, has sung these songs 1,000 times, knows them like the back of her hand. And so it was really great to kind of revisit her old catalog with her, hear kind of a much more polished version of them, and then obviously get some new music, which we'll talk about. But what about you? What were your thoughts generally?
It's a similar reaction to you, although I did know that she wanted to go in to re-recording these by preserving the original integrity and spirit of each song. And I totally respect that. And that makes sense to me. A part of me couldn't help but be disappointed by the potential she left behind. I know we've talked about wanting stripped down albums from her, and she gave us a hint of that with the piano version of Forever and Always, which I personally find to be really gut-wrenching and beautiful, and I completely fell in love with that version. And I just couldn't help but wonder, like, what would all of the songs have sounded like when done like this? And so I really hope one day, you know, when she's kind of done with her main I'm touring, like when after maybe she's had a couple kids and she just wants to do fun things for like shits and giggles, I hope she like does stripped down versions of everything and we get like really clean, beautiful ballad versions of every song she's ever done. That's my hope.
Yeah, and I think it's just obviously the circumstances of needing to re-record her masters because of all of the issues created by Scott Borchetta, Big Machine Records, and Scooter Braun, that we can't have MTV Unplugged type stuff, right? And granted, I think we definitely still have a chance at getting that stuff in concert. And mind you, she now has 3 entire albums that she hasn't toured yet, which is crazy to me. And this process is going to take a really long time. She has 5 other albums she needs to re-record, plus touring those 3 albums. And then I'm sure she wants to write new music. I think, you know, it's definitely a ways down to your point, but at least we kind of get the hints of the piano version and little things like that that she'll throw us. But what was your reception at the time when it first came out?
So 2008, I was still in college. This album was my first introduction to Taylor Swift. I remember a friend in one of my journalism classes being like, "Have you heard the song Hey Steven? It's really good." And then I like laughed at the title because it sounded so, for lack of a better word, it just sounded really juvenile, and I like laughed. And then my friend was like, "No, you have to like listen to the song. It's actually really good. And you have to listen to the entire album. It's really, really good." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And then I did. And that's when I was like, "Oh, shit. This girl's an amazing writer. Hey, Steven's one of my favorite songs. She was totally right." And there are just like very nostalgic memories I have tied to this album. Like, I remember once a couple of friends and I were studying and like pulling an all-nighter at one of NYU's libraries, and like we just played Love Story over and over again to keep us sort of motivated and wanting to like study. And so there are just things about this album that really I have nostalgic ties to and I loved. But I thought it was really interesting because like a lot of the songs that I really responded to off of this album were the singles. Like, I loved You Belong With Me. Obviously, we all loved Love Story, and I loved Fearless and Forever and Always. But I found upon listening to the Taylor's version that she just released, like, there are so many of the ballads that I have new appreciation for just because her vocals are so much stronger, like you said, and the production value is much higher. And so I found that to be a really interesting experience to rediscover these ballads I didn't really have full appreciation for before. What about you? Like, where were you in 2008? And like, was this album your introduction to Taylor Swift, or were you an OG, like Tim McGraw, Teardrops fan?
So yeah, this came out November 11, 2008. So I had just graduated from college earlier, I guess that May. And yeah, so just in a very different place, obviously, as was Taylor. She was 18 when this came out. At the time, I really loved it. And I think similar to you, I wasn't necessarily gravitating towards some of the ballads and maybe for me particular in some of kind of the back half of the album, particularly some of the kind of extra deluxe tracks starting around, I think, like Jump Then Fall, like some of that stuff, I just was like, eh, whatever. But this was not my first introduction to Taylor. I was a fan already with Tim McGraw. That's actually one of my all-time favorite Taylor songs. I can't not listen to that song and just feel like all the feels. And so I don't remember which song I heard first, Tim McGraw or Teardrops, but I definitely, that was my entry point, was that album. I used to listen to 97.1, the LA country radio station, driving around back in the day. And I was like listening to like Kelly Pickler and like all that stuff. I don't recall if Carrie was quite out yet or not, Underwood, but in any case, yeah, I just similar experience to you in terms of kind of appreciating some of the songs more now. And maybe it was because, you know, I was in college and like dating and like, you know, all the kind of trials and tribulations of like young people and love and heartbreak and all that stuff. And I think just like the pace of the songs, I definitely gravitated towards more of like the bigger bops, like You Belong With Me, I think is like the biggest bop for me on the album then and now. Mm-hmm. But The Way I Loved You was like one of, it's like probably one of the best songs to scream sing while you're driving with the windows down, like on the freeway or something like that. It's just like, those to me are like the best country songs. It's why I like country music for long drives or just, I don't know, there's something about the way that that music feels when you're in a moving vehicle and you got like the wind in your hair and all that stuff. It's just perfect. But yeah, Hey Steven, definitely up there. Fearless, Fervent Always, also bops. But like even Jump Then Fall, and I don't know if it's because of the production of this Taylor version, but you really hear the instruments and like the real country twang of it all really comes out, and it's just like a country bop. If I was still driving nowadays, I don't drive that much anymore, but I would like drive bop to this song. It's very good. And so I like that. I like that we get to revisit old music that I honestly wouldn't have done otherwise and find new things to appreciate either in songs we've already heard or obviously like these new songs, which let's just talk about the new songs. What are your general thoughts about the new songs and how would you rank them?
Just to backtrack to The Way I Loved You, I just have to give that another shout out because I re-listening to Taylor's version of it, I was like, this morning, I was like, holy shit, this is such a good song. And it really hits you right in the feels. And you do want to like scream it like as soon as you hear it. And I just think that that's so special. But that being said, I don't know, like I feel like a lot of the Taylor stans are going to come for me, but I just don't feel that way about most of the songs from The Vault. I think there's a reason why they were cut, and I think maybe they should have kind of stayed on the cutting room floor. In context of this album, I do like the Maren Morris song a little bit more than when I had heard it like individually as a like a sort of teaser release single, You All Over Me. Like when you're listening to the entire album and you hear this one, I'm like, okay, I get it. Like I really like this song now. But in terms of the rest of them, I like That's When with Keith Urban, but the rest of them are pretty, like, they kind of blend together for me and are a little bit forgettable. I feel really bad saying that, but what do you think?
So, few things. I agree. I like That's When. I think that was my one or two of the six in terms of rankings. I really liked Don't You. And the thing that I really think is interesting about this song is that, so all these Vault tracks were part of the Fearless era, meaning to say they didn't make the cut, but they were written by Taylor during those recording sessions. So she was 13 to 16 years old. So keep that in mind. But the cool thing, again, about this whole project of the not only recontextualizing old songs is that she gets to recontextualize old songs that were never released. So she's not restricted by having to preserve an original melody that fans already know. And she gets to produce them in any style she wants now. You know, she isn't necessarily having to keep them kind of in theme. We've talked about before, like, you know, she's been burned a little bit by the Academy in the past, like with Red in particular for being a little bit too all over the place. And now she's trying to
never get over Red.
Yeah. Well, she just got her other new album of the year. So I think she's starting to cool off.
She's fine now.
But, you know, she can be playful. She can experiment and she can take advantage of all the producers she's worked with in the past 13 years. So I say all that because Aaron Dessner and Jack Antonoff actually produced these six Vault tracks, and it comes out the most on Don't You because there's clear Jack Antonoff synths on this song. And so I really liked it because of that. And so what I think is really cool is she gets to take songs that she wrote when she was 13 to 16, but she gets to like produce them as this 30-plus-year-old woman with some of the best producers in the world. Like, if she goes back to her other catalog and says, you know what, I want to, like, redo this song I never released and do it with Max Martin. Like, she can do that now. She couldn't do that when she was that age. And so she has this really interesting opportunity to kind of take the best of both worlds and, like, introduce the world to new music that she wrote when she was younger, but doing it at a very, very high level, high production level with some of the best producers in the world. And so I think that's really cool. So That's When and Don't You Are My Top Two. I agree. You All Over Me didn't hit me when it first was released, but within the whole context of the re-release, I'm into it. Mr. Perfectly Fine, I'm only interested for the Taylor, as La Cool Teresa's would say of it, the Taylor of it, which is that everyone assumes this is about Joe Jonas and the fact that Sophie Turner posted this song saying it's amazing. not a bop.
I love Sophie Turner so much.
It's honestly the only reason the song is on anybody's radar, because it's like, it's okay. I think this is probably maybe one of the only songs that probably would have done okay if it had been included, but it's really only relevant for us now as a fun look back, like, hey, remember when you used to only write about the boys you dated and, like, you, like, were just so in your feels about Joe Jonas, and, like, we can laugh about it now, which again is a cool part of this process. And Taylor reposted that thing from Sophie saying, I bow to the King of the North or something like that. So it's just,
I always bend the knee to the Queen of the North. Yeah, I love that so much.
Yeah, I think that's just a really cool part of this process that she gets to do all that. And again, this just really interesting interweaving of, like, old Taylor, new Taylor, finding ways to kind of re-envision yourself and not right some wrongs, but just having just, like, new perspective as, like, someone who's mature and been through things. And, like, another thing that people are talking about is track 13, Change, and how different the meaning of that song is now. Like, when she was writing that the first time, it was about, you know, her being this, like, small town girl, up against the odds, like, with this, like, no-name label sort of, trying to make it in the country world. And she wrote it after she won the Horizon Awards at the CMAs in 2007. And just kind of as a look back of, like, wow, look at how far we've come. And so then to have all the context of, like, look how far she's come now. And not only in her career, but with this re-release of, like, overcoming odds, overcoming all the people who were getting in her way, aka Scott Borchetta and Scooter Braun. I think it's just, like, a part of this really cool meta narrative project that we're all participating in. So I don't know. It's been a fun process. But yeah, if none of these vault tracks came out, I wouldn't miss them. But I think in particular, the Don't You track is interesting for that reason of, like, being able to re-release or being able to introduce a new song, but with your current creative team working on a song that you wrote 20 years ago, right?
Yeah. So out of all of the Joe Jonas-inspired songs in Taylor's canon, which one would you say is your favorite?
That's a great question. I'm just trying to think of, like, all of them, first of all. There are so many. Is Holy Ground about him?
I don't think that one's about him, but I've heard rumors that it's about him. But I do love that song. So if that song is inspired about him, that changes my pick.
Yeah. So if it's about him, that is number one by a long shot. It's one of her best songs of all time. If it's not, Forever and Always is probably the best one.
Okay, so if Holy Ground is not, then Last Kiss is my favorite. I love that song so much. It's on Speak Now. I think it's really, really good, and it's so sad, and it's so sweet, and it's just so good, man.
So surprisingly, I don't know if you had this, but there was one song that I actively was mad about that I was like, you know what? This song, I get it now. I kind of get it now.
On this specific album or song? Okay.
The Best Day. I get it now.
Interesting.
Okay, so the guitars. Okay, first of all, I never noticed that there was percussion on the song. I don't know why. I just maybe never listened to it loud enough or with the right equipment. I never heard the percussion. Ever. Like, if you told me that song had percussion, I'd be like, where is it? It's very clearly at the beginning. Like, you could hear, like, the maracas or there's something, right? It's very clearly there for whatever reason. I was like, oh, no, it wasn't there on the original. I listened to it. No, it's definitely there. I just never noticed it. The guitar is just so much crisper and clearer. And it just, I'm not going to say it changed the entire song for me, but just, again, going through this exercise and just like re-listening to it. I don't know. I think it's because I was focused more on the music. I still think it's, you know, some of her songs about her mom. And I think it makes sense. Do feel like infantilized, which I think, you know, that connection makes sense, right? It's about your mom. You're feeling like a child, whatever. So I still don't jive as much with like the sing songy lullaby type of lyrics, but I'm into the melody. I think it just the production quality, because it's more polished, it does feel less juvenile for some of these songs. And I think we're able to appreciate them because she's coming to it with like this deeper voice, and we're not listening to a 15-year-old talk about how she's 15. It's like this 30-year-old woman who's like looking back on her life and like being nostalgic, which I think is really interesting. But we'll take a quick break. We'll wrap on Taylor's version of Fearless. Did you have any experience like that? Like any songs that you weren't really into as much? Like, I know we kind of generally talked about it, but was there any song in specific that you were like, okay, yeah, I'm into it a little bit now?
Yeah, there were a couple of the ballads.
Okay.
Untouchable and Breathe, for example, were songs that I usually skipped when I would listen in 2008. But for some reason, I think to your point of Taylor's voice just being much more mature and the production quality being a lot higher, I was able to really focus on the emotion of those tracks. And I think her delivery is a lot more nuanced and mature for me, at least. And so I really found myself gravitating toward those tracks in a way that I hadn't before. With that said, I still really don't like the song 15. I never liked it. I didn't really like it in 2008, and I skipped it this time around. Did you listen to it?
Yeah, I listened to the whole thing just for purity of the exercise. Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of it either back then. I think, again, I appreciate it in this kind of meta revisiting history exercise of thinking about how she had written that song within 2 years of being 15 and already feeling nostalgic. But now it feels more natural. Like you would look back on your life and almost talk to your daughter or your son about when you were 15 or whatever. Like it felt more natural as a narrative structure of her being kind of wistful about her youth. It was more than half her life ago, which is like crazy now. The harmonies I noticed a lot more this time around, and so that was nice too.
Yeah, I think the thing about that song that really bugs me though is that, and it's always kind of bugged me, that it really wasn't her experience. Not to say that she's not allowed to write about other people's experiences, just, and I don't know, I think it's hard because at the time I was listening to it, and obviously Abigail's still her best friend and was her best friend at the time. But I kept thinking, like, is Abigail okay with you writing so intimately and vulnerably about this time in her life? And there was something about it that just felt really too personal and for me, and it really kind of bugged me.
Yeah, I would say maybe that explains her Lena Dunham relationship more than anything, because it is a very Lena Dunham / Hannah Horvath move to be like, everything is copy, including my best friend's life experience at 15. It's very like a writer thing to do. Do you know what I mean? I'm not justifying in any sense, but it very much feels in the vein of that, which is interesting. So like talking about the new tracks and even like Colby coming back for that Breathe recording, it's the same grape that I said before. And I think you agreed with me. Let the women sing, Taylor. I'm sorry, but like, what the fuck is up with this bullshit background vocal harmony thing? Okay, you let all the men get verses. Let the fucking women sing a verse, for God's sake. You're gonna claim that you have Colby Calais and Merritt Morris on your album? Colby is barely noticeable on this. Barely noticeable.
Yeah, I don't know. I think my opinion on this has kind of softened since we last talked about it, mostly because I think that she's just kind of used to, you know, when she's on other people's tracks as a feature, she's also filling in on the background as well. And so I think it's natural for her to feel like when somebody's a feature for her, that they would be her background as well. And I don't know. I think listening to the Ringer Every Taylor Swift Ever podcast really softened my opinion on this, mostly because, I mean, she has historically worked with a lot of women, and I totally understand what you're saying. And I really wish that she had worked with more females and they're more obviously featured on the tracks. But, you know, No Body, No Crime, for example, I just feel like that track works so well, and it's because Haim is really like harmonizing throughout. Well, and she does the same thing on Gasoline too.
Okay, but then they released the remix, and that was unquestionably better. Come at me with your comments, but I dare you to tell me the remix isn't better, because Taylor is so much more present in that, and you could really feel like it's a collaboration, not like, hey, come fucking like doo-wop and sing background for me. I'm sorry. Those are two different things to me. It's two different levels. I think it's just with the amount of collaborations and the fact that in almost every case, with very few exceptions, the men get a more prominent role. I think it's just weird. I think it's just strange. And I just... to say it's like purely a service of the song, like, I don't know. How is it always that it's only in service of the song when the males like get to speak, like get to speak?
Well, I think in those cases too, when Justin Vernon is featured on a track or the National is featured on a track, she very much has positioned those as duets, whereas the other tracks are features. And I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's just like a very confusing optics, because when she goes on tour, I don't know how this is going to look like in the future, but definitely in her heyday of fucking like girl gang, girl squad, whatever, of 1989, she famously was bringing out really big kind of like cameo features in especially some of the big cities. And so she would have like Selena Gomez come, she would have... Hayley Kiyoko come, she would have Maren Moore, she would have all these artists, and she would let them do their thing. And I just don't know why that's different than in a recording situation. So, I mean, to each their own, and like, I'm sure there's valid points for each, but in my personal view, it's just confusing for me how someone who's so musically creative only finds ways to make it work with male vocals in more prominent parts in the song. That's it. I just think it's strange. I just wish I could hear more of those collaborations. I think the Dixie Chicks was also completely wasted in that song. So
yeah, no, I totally get it.
And I honestly think that was the same with Haim. Like, I put those on the same level. I know they were on that song, but if you compared.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand what you're saying, and it's a valid point. I've come to really appreciate the background vocals of Breathe and songs like Clean and No Body, No Crime. I do feel like the harmonizing that Haim does on No Body, No Crime really adds value to the song. But I totally understand what you're saying, and I think you're completely right that she should be able to collaborate with more female artists and give them the floor to showcase their vocals more. But I don't think that one thing negates the other. And I also think that, like, you know, when she collaborated with John Mayer on Half of My Heart, that she very much was the background vocal there. And so I think that's just kind of, for whatever reason, the way that she's learned to collaborate.
Yeah. And so I don't know. I'm sure she has her own like artistic reasons for it. I think it's just confusing for me because it doesn't feel as consistent than when she has males, because when she has an Ed Sheeran, when she has Keith Urban, although he does do background vocals admittedly on We Were Happy, and he's only harmonies, and then he's a lead in That's When. But I don't know, just always thought it was a little strange, and just something I'd love to see a little bit different in the future. But other than that, yeah, generally happy with how this went. It's just that, like, I guess for me, if she starts like hinting at like, oh, like she's already announced actually that Selena Gomez is going to be part of something in the future. And again, I said it last time, but it's rumored, and Katy Perry basically kind of hinted at it on American Idol, which the clip went viral, that she might be involved. It's not something I'm going to get excited about because I just, for me personally and what I would want to see in a collaboration, I just don't think it's ever going to be at a level that I can personally get excited about. It sounds like a lot of people still enjoy the level, which is cool. I think I just would love to see more is all.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair, but maybe it's coming, you know, maybe the Katy Perry collab and maybe the Selena collab will be amazing. We just don't know yet.
No, I'm not going to get excited because this is like, I'm going to under expect for the rest of these re-releases that I'm not going to get anything interesting from a cameo. And if she surprises me, I would fucking love it. But I'm not going to sit here and wait for an amazing Katy Perry Bad Blood re-release that's dope as hell or a Selena thing when it's probably just going to be like them swaying in the background, which is fine, whatever. That's what she decides to do. She's the master of this whole situation. And like, fuck, she's a boss. She could do whatever she wants. I think that is the biggest point, is that she's in control and she can do whatever she wants. And honestly, like, more power to her.
So if we haven't heard officially the order in which the re-releases are supposed to occur, what would you say you're most excited about next?
I think we all know what comes next. One word. It's a color. It's red. I want red. I wanted it yesterday. Give it to me now. Give me red right fucking now. Oh my God. It'll be 10 years old next year, which is crazy.
That's nuts.
I'm not like a studio musician, but I'm assuming like, again, the equipment and the technology has improved since then. And so if they can find ways to make that stuff sound even better, oh my God, I would die. That is just such a great album. So I would want that next. Keep Reputation in the vault. Don't need it actually ever. Thank you. Maybe some select singles. Throw me a Delicate. Throw me a Getaway Car. Don't need the rest.
I think that's tough because there are a lot of Taylor fans and stans out there that like love that album.
I swear to God, I've only listened to that album in its completion once, and that was like 2 years ago.
So apparently there is a 6-minute super long edition of All Too Well that we haven't heard yet.
Ooh, yes. Give me the uncut. Yes. Oh, God, yeah. Anything like about John Mayer or Jake Gyllenhaal that's been unreleased or has a longer version, pump it into my veins immediately. Like, ooh. Those two got her in her fucking feels and it created some of the best music out of her. And I'll take anything that she wrote in that era. So Red would be next, followed by 1989. I guess Speak Now. Okay, look. And then I would just want Tim McGraw as a single, like bumped up. And then Speak Now. And then her, I would honestly take the self-titled over, like, just literally Reputation is dead last or never. I don't care for it. What would your order be?
I think I would definitely want Red and then Speak Now and then 1989 and then Taylor Swift. I think I just have a lot of nostalgia and emotional attachment to the Red album and where I was at in my life during that time. And similarly to 1989, I just love those two. And I think I said Speak Now, but I would actually want Red and then 1989 and then Speak Now and then Taylor. That would be my ideal.
Interesting. What do you think about how she redid the cover art for this?
I think it's fine. I think what you were alluding to before is that there's something really interesting about seeing Taylor through the years and seeing her style evolve and seeing her use different choices and fonts and colors and things like that. And something like that gets lost in these versions. And so, you know, that kind of makes me sad, but I didn't, like, this version didn't really, of the cover art, didn't really knock my socks off or do anything special for me and my soul. Whereas I feel like the original Fearless album cover is very iconic to me and for a couple of different reasons, mostly because of her hair.
Yeah, it definitely feels like a TBT sepia tone Instagram picture that's meant to like evoke nostalgia more than be a brand new iteration, which I guess is the entire process, so it feels apt. I do think that there's something just not missing, but it's just a different experience, you know, being able to have all of those albums, whether they're CDs or vinyls or whatever, or even like looking at your Spotify and seeing that kind of progression. Like, you know, she uses that Taylor Swift signature logo for the first three albums, and then she drops it with Red, and then that's kind of when she really just experiments in different styles throughout. But it'll be interesting to see if she kind of like picks up on the different kind of symbols of each of the albums. Like Speak Now obviously is like the purple dress and just like kind of the purple era, I guess, maybe. And then 1989 is the Polaroid. So maybe there's like a fun way where she could like still pay homage to those eras, but do it in a new and interesting way. I don't know. But knowing her, she probably already has like this master plan of like all of the album arts, like spelling out a letter or something. I don't know. She's like, she has all her Easter egg ways, so maybe she'll do something cool with it. I don't know. She's really good at that, so it'll be interesting to see.
Do you think there might be a difference, or do you think it'll seem that she'll have less of a difference in style and tone once she gets to her more recent albums? Like, I'm wondering what you think 1989, that cover, is going to look like.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. I didn't even really think about the album art piece of it, but again, maybe there's parts of it that she wants to recontextualize. If, for example, in this Fearless Taylor version album art, I think people were saying that she's wearing this kind of like man's tunic, and it's supposed to represent that she's her own prince. You know, obviously this era, this curly hair era, is very much like the fairy tale era. She has many songs that has fairy tale imagery in these first three albums, especially Speak Now and Fearless. And so this was kind of meant to kind of reclaim that and be more of an empowered, independent woman. And so, you know, 1989, there, I believe, is the one where there's a few Harry Styles references, and I feel like she has like birds on her shirt in the Polaroid, and I don't know if that was supposed to be like a reference to the cranes and like that whole thing. So like maybe she wants to wear a different shirt, you know, maybe there's stuff like that. I don't know.
I have to say, Style is one of my favorite songs of all time.
It's great.
Like, I think if I had to choose between boyfriend-inspired songs, it would be really hard for me to choose between Jake and Harry Styles. Although, Jake inspired All Too Well, and...
The scarf. No, the scarf gets me every time. The scarf gets me every time, guys. Okay, and then I immediately think of the paparazzi photo when they're walking. That's it. That's it for me, guys. And she says, it's at your sister's house. Like, I'm done. Like, that's it for me. Like, Jake G, like, that was the one for me.
Oh, Jake.
Just rethink Reputation. Like, does it need to be re-released, Taylor? That's all.
I feel like that is tough because there are so many people in the Taylor stan hive that really love Reputation.
Now that I'm thinking about it, though, it actually might be the most interesting one for me personally, because it is the one that I was most resistant to, because it was a part of her life where she was very much in the rebel phase. She felt like she was getting, you know, she was feeling like the peak of the brunt of the media and like all the Kanye stuff and all that kind of like negative stuff. And so, again, in the context of revisiting one's history, recontextualizing and coming at it with a different perspective, could she actually turn this into an album that I enjoy? Excellent challenge. I'm into it. Let's hear it. I actually want to see this because maybe I will like it.
Wow. Growth.
And, you know, it's all just attitude. It was just her whole attitude that era. And, you know, it was totally normal for her to be that way. She's a human being and she obviously has been through a lot. So I don't know. I think it's just a lot of it is optics and perception and just history. And I think it'll be actually, now that I think about it, a really interesting exercise to kind of revisit it as a fan with new perspective and see if new Taylor will maybe actually make me appreciate that album even more.
So much growth right here in real time, ladies and gentlemen.
Here we go, guys. This is what it's all about, okay? Growth, people, growth. 2021.
All right. Well, if you made it this far, thank you for listening. Please follow us at Repeak Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Please leave us a 5-star review.
In 2 weeks, we're talking Woo! Mortal Kombat. We'll see you then.
Mortal Kombat.